the OTB Podcast Network.
They spoke about your arm not being down beside your side. I mean, this is not Irish dancing.
OTB Sports Radio.
Basketball would have been my main game.
The brand new sports radio station from Off the Ball.
That's my point. Don't play for us if you're a proud Englishman.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day, live on the Go Loud app, Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home, tune in, and offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio. Football on Off the Ball
with Paddy Power,
the greatest football partnership since Shearer and Owen.
Now you're very welcome back. Get your text in for our next guest. 53106 is the text number. We are at Off the Ball on Twitter. He started at Preston in 1974. It was the old Third Division or League One in today's money. He was there until 77 when he moved to Brighton, where he stayed until 1981. That was in the second division, the championship, and then a promotion to the old first division. And then, of course, Liverpool between 1981 and 1988. In total, 581 senior club games, plus his 39 Irish caps across the 1980s as well. We're talking five league titles, European Cup, three League Cups, one FA Cup, and a few other bits and pieces besides, I'm sure, as well. Mark Lawrenson, how you doing?
Good, thank you. You?
Very well. That doesn't sound too shabby. Are you happy with your lot?
Yeah. I want to complain. I mean, when I made my debut for Preston, basically, I thought that was the pinnacle because, you know, my dad had played there. My mum had remarried and my stepfather was on the board of directors and everything. And all my mates, I was still at school technically, and all my mates came to watch me make my debut and everything. So I just thought, well, that's me done. So the rest was an absolute bonus, in all honesty.
How are things going at the moment? How goes self-isolation?
All right, which is why I couldn't Skype, because I'm absolutely useless and my son's not here. So, I don't mind a bit of self-isolation. I've been watching this thing on the telly. Have you heard a channel in America called PBS?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've been watching all the stuff about the Vietnam War. Oh, my goodness me, the lies told by politicians is frightening, isn't it?
Well, nothing has changed, I suspect.
No, I would say still the same.
PBS, it's full of brilliant documentaries, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the one. I mean, I think there's 10 about the Vietnam War, and I think they're over 2 hours each, so I could just do with a few more to keep me going.
Yeah. So, look, this is a freewheeling chat and we'll go wherever the conversation takes us. I did want to ask you about punditry these days and your relationship with punditry. Do you still like it? Are you kind of over it? You know, is it something that you're going to stop doing, or will you keep doing it as long as the requests come in?
I think I'll probably keep doing it because I just want to try what little bit of brain I've got left just to keep it working. I still go to loads of games, even if I'm not working anyway. I go watch Liverpool, go and watch Preston and stuff, but no, I quite like it. It's amazing now when you think punditry. It's just an absolutely massive business. When I first started, because I packed in, didn't I, at 29, 30. When I first started, there were few and far between people who you would call actually pundits. In fact, the word pundit wasn't even invented for quite a few years after we started.
Is that right?
Yeah, we didn't call us anything. If you know, when we worked on Match of the Day, me and Hanson, we were just like, well, no, the two lads are on Match of the Day. It wasn't like listen to the pundits. It would just be listen to Alan Hanson and Mark Lawrenson or whatever it was. So, yeah, I mean, I think it was quite a few years afterwards before someone actually said, oh, you're a pundit. And I went, what the hell was one of them?
I'm curious about Hanson. So you know him a long time, obviously a partnership in various guises. There is, whether anyone wants to admit it or not, there is a certain appeal in fame or limelight or attention or whatever. And he seems to have just, you know, when he reached the end of his days at Match of the Day, just disappeared from public life. Like, I never seen him do an interview anywhere. I never see him popping up anywhere. He seems to have just said, good night, good luck, I'm done.
Exactly. Exactly. Even when Kenny Dalglish got his knighted, Al said to him, don't expect me to do anything. Because he just said to everybody, in fairness to him, you know, obviously he had all those years at the BBC, but he said to everybody, look, I'm not doing anything for anybody, because as soon as I do one thing for somebody, you'll be right on the phone to me saying, you can do this, you've done it for them, etc., etc. So He spends his time mostly on the golf course, although he's got a bad knee at the moment and he's needing a new knee. But it's I think the fear of the knife is not particularly something he's looking forward to. But he's around. I saw him the other day. He's all good. He's a granddad and everything. So would you believe I quite often seen him walking into the village where we all live, pushing the kids and stuff. So I just say to him, Cole, how the mighty have fallen. But no, he's good otherwise.
And did he dislike fame? Did he dislike the attention that even Match of the Day brought?
Did he dislike it? No, I don't think he disliked it, because it, you know, quite honestly, it opens a lot of doors and the pay was good, etc. I think what he hated in the end was the travel up and down to London. I mean, people do it for a living all the time now, every single day. But, you know, obviously getting to the airport, waiting for the plane and all that kind of stuff. And if you fly into Heathrow on a regular basis, it can be an absolute nightmare. Mm. He so didn't like that. And he's just a real homebird. I met Janet, his wife, the other day in Tesco's, actually, and we were just laughing about all the stuff, and I just said, how easy? She said, well, have a guess where he is. Well, I didn't need to guess where he is, because obviously he was on the golf course. But he's all good, and Al was always, I would say, he's not a massive football fan. He very rarely goes to watch Liverpool, sometimes because he's got other things on that he's doing and he's with the grandkids or something, but he's not, you know, he wouldn't go on a regular basis to go and watch them. And that's just the way he is. I mean, I would go and watch, like, you know, my sister's little lad and stuff like that, go play, you know, for whoever in the park and stuff. But Al's not that way.
Yeah. This is a really strange thing here. So I have a TV on in the studio, you know, and obviously it's showing loads of archive stuff because there's no live sport to show. This is just a spooky thing. I wanted to ask you about Des Lynam. Des Lynam has just popped up on the TV in front
of
me. It's a freakish moment, actually. So Des Lynam, he was pretty much the man.
Oh, Desmond, yeah, what a cool dude. He first interviewed me long before he got the presenter as Match of the Day and Grandstand, etc. He was a massive Brighton fan. And he came down to interview on the South Coast. So that would be kind of, you know, late 70s. And I'll never forget, I met him at the Greyhound Stadium, which was really close to the ground. It was just a convenient place to do the interview. And it's for the old Topical Times football book. I don't know if you ever remember that.
No.
Well, everybody had it at Christmas, basically, because obviously football was nothing like it is today in the way with the press, etc. But yeah, I was doing this piece of Topical Times football book about myself playing for Brighton and Ireland and what I've been. He's got his Irish connections as well, Des. So I met him after training. It would be about 1 o'clock at lunchtime, and we parted company about 12 hours later after going trawling through all the pubs in Brighton and Hove, etc. So we became good friends from that particular moment. But he was just really, really cool. A lot of the time he didn't use autocue when he was presenting, etc. And he had a fantastic command of the English language, etc. But I don't think he's too well now at the moment. I think he's struggling a little bit. I don't know if it's Alzheimer's, dementia, whatever it is, but he's not in the greatest of health, I'm afraid.
Okay, sorry to hear that. We wish him well. Was he a perfectionist? Was he demanding, or was he relaxed, or what was his modus operandi?
No, he was relaxed, Des. You would have no idea. And he always had a twinkle in his eye, always liked a little bit of a laugh and a joke. But he was one of those who, you know, when he did the programme, because it's always done live, that's the other thing, it would have to be right for him. But he was great. He was great with people around him. He'd obviously give them the odd bollocking if someone had seriously messed up, or the editor would be speaking in his ear while he was trying to say something on air and stuff like that. But I think if you asked anybody who worked with him, they would say he was just a top guy. Loved the drink. He was a great tourist when we used to go and do all the World Cups, etc. And he just loved the kind of lads, you know, all different footballers. Because he liked listening to the stories and have a few beers and have the crack, basically.
I presume punditry at those World Cups was great fun, or the European Championships. Were there any standout ones for you?
First one I did really, which was France, because we were just based in Paris for 5 weeks. We could walk to the studio from the hotel. obviously we must have passed about 20 bars on the way. So we had our floor manager, who'd been out there a week before us, he kind of he identified the bar, or it was more like a pub actually, that became HQ, became headquarters for us. And it was just fabulous fun, and just basically watching football all day and going out for dinner and having a few pints and then starting again the next day. Jimmy Hill was actually working with us as well, and Jimmy was one of those guys who just, we played golf a few times very early in the morning, because sometimes in the afternoon games we could play at 7 in the morning and be done by 11. Jimmy, we'd always say to Jimmy, come, we're going to play in the morning. We think, me and Lineker used to say, he'll never get up at 5:45 to come and play golf. He's in his 70s, and he did. He never, ever missed. And Jimmy Hill and Des were absolutely massive mates. They were, I would say, Des always looked after Jimmy. I would think that's probably the best way to describe the relationship.
Mm. That was a fantastic tournament as well, even watching from afar. I mean, it was brilliant football, really, you know, interesting teams. And am I right in saying that David Ginola, watching, I suspect, in some kind of anguish, because he was about to win Footballer of the Year the following season, you know, he was peak of his powers. He was part of that punditry team at the time, wasn't he?
David, he was. But he really kind of stamped his superstar status, because he didn't stay in the same hotel we were staying. He stayed, I don't know how well you know Paris, is a fabulous hotel just around the corner from our studio there, called Le Crillon, it was called. And he was staying in there. I mean, don't think for a moment our digs were shabby. They certainly weren't, but his were most definitely five star. But I remember the first day he turned up for work, and he had his agent with him, etc. And obviously we'd signed him for the whole of the competition, which is what lasts about 4 or 5 weeks altogether, with the pre sort of days 3 or 4 before. And in the first day, watching the first game, when we were just sat in the studio watching it, and it was really hot day, so we had like these big doors that opened out onto a terrace at the back, and he went outside as the game was on and had a ciggy. And our boss is thinking, hold on a minute, what's happening here? And the boss is thinking, well, he's not particularly got a real kind of eye or concentrating on this game. And then just after half time, when we'd done all the analysis, his agent came into the studio while the game was on the second half and said, oh, David now has to go.
Stop.
and Niall Sloan, our boss, he went, we can imagine where he went, absolutely, what do you mean he's got to go? He said, oh, he's got to go because he's got to go to the stadium to go and watch the French play. Well, Niall soon sorted that out. But he was fine. He was fine. He was just... When we did the final, obviously, because, you know, obviously everyone knows that the French won and it was a fantastic night, etc. Yeah. We were in this kind of minibus coming back from the stadium to go back into Paris and to have our rap party, as they call it. And he was sat in the front, and I'll never forget it. We're in and out of all the traffic, and everyone's talking about the game and, you know, the story behind the game and the Brazilians and Ronaldo, all that kind of stuff. And he from inside the van, he punched the roof. And I thought, he must surely have bust all his fingers or whatever. But that was, I think, he suddenly realised that he'd missed out on it all, had he? And wasn't it Julio who blamed him for...
Yes.
Giving the ball away against Israel, wasn't it?
Bulgaria, I think. I'm not sure. But we interviewed him a couple of years ago. And, I mean, initially he was reluctant to talk about it. But he confessed, and this was about 5 years ago, he said he thinks about missing out on the World Cup every single day. It's haunted him, effectively. Yeah, Julier threw him under the bus. I mean, he gave away the ball when he could have just held on to it. He stuck in a cross, they broke away, scored. France didn't reach USA 94, and that was kind of him done. So... you know, terribly unfair, really. And I can imagine having to watch them win the World Cup in Paris. And
torture.
The dawning realisation that they're all immortal for the rest of their lives, and you're the forgotten man.
Yeah, well, I mean, I coached him at Newcastle when I was there with KK, with Kevin Keegan, and fantastic ability. And he was a big, strong, imposing guy as well. Yeah. And I'll never forget, we were playing at home, playing against Arsenal, who were, you know, obviously a very, very good side themselves. And David was playing. We call him David. We always, because he just says, "You call me David." And we were like, "David." And he was playing on the left side, left wing, basically. And he kept cutting inside with the ball. And our front two would have been Shearer and Les Ferdinand.
Mm.
And, you know, they were just trying to get in the box to try and get on the end of the cross. Well, honestly, the first 45 minutes, he must have done it 20 times, kept cutting inside, and then he set a cross, and he had a look at Shearer and Ferdinand to make a run, and then decided to beat the fullback again. So whistle goes for half-time. We're 1-0 down, and there's Kevin, Terry McDermott and myself. And Kevin said, let's just stay here for a minute and let them get in the dressing room. So very cleverly, and he did that. We were there about 2 or 3 minutes. As we got into the dressing room, Shearer had him up against the wall. He had David up against the wall, and you know, obviously he was effing and jeffing at him, and basically was saying to him, if you do not cross that so-and-so ball first time in the second half, I am going to knock your lights out. Well, guess what he did?
I would imagine so. Kevin Keegan brought you in as defensive coach, if memory serves.
Yeah. I never took a session until the morning after Kevin resigned. Because when I got there, he said to me, right, he said, train with the first team, do whatever as well, while the game's on, playing the five-a-sides and all those kind of things. He said, but I just want you to look at us for 2 or 3 months. Well, everybody knew defensively they weren't quite good enough. I mean, you could work that out in about 20 seconds. And he obviously fell out with the board about the fact that they were going to be, obviously, on the stock market, all those kind of things. And Kevin thought he should have one thing and another, and quite rightly he should have done. And they basically said he'd got to sign a new contract, but I don't think they offered him any shares. I think that was the basic problem with all of it. And Kevin, being Kevin, just decided one day that was it.
Mm.
So the very next morning we are training, and Arthur Cox, who was kind of Kevin's guru as much as anything, and he'd been the first team coach at Preston when I was a kid, when I was 14 or 15, and he used to come to training on a Tuesday night and kick me for like half an hour of the game that we used to play, and it took me 3 or 4 games to realise, you know, I need to kick him back. And the day I kicked him back, he came over and shook my hand, Arthur, and said, my work here is done and cleared off. Yeah, great story, isn't it? And anyway, Arthur Cox was sort of temporary in charge the next morning, and he said, right, Mark, go and do what you've been paid to do for the last 3 months but haven't done. So then I just did a bit of coaching, obviously.
You had your spells at Oxford and Peterborough. So this is just pre you really, you know, being Mr. Match of the Day. Mm. Why did you go down the route of Match of the Day versus taking more of a punt in management? Did it not light your fire?
No, I loved it. I loved it. But my problem was I was the youngest manager ever in what was Division One, which is obviously, you know, the Premier League. Now I was just turned 30, and obviously I was working for Robert Maxwell, but ostensibly my immediate boss was his son, Kevin. He was a really, really nice guy, but became Britain's youngest ever biggest bankrupt, didn't he? But I fell out with him. I took over the job very, very late March. The transfer window had finished, and they were going down, Oxford, unfortunately. They didn't have any great resources. But we had Dean Saunders, and I'd got Dean Saunders to sign a new contract for 3 years, saying, look, do 1 year in the next division, and if we don't get promotion, you know, you can go to one of a number of clubs, because they'd already been on the phone to me, all the big boys from Division One and stuff. Anyway, basically, Robert Maxwell, who owned Derby as well as Oxford, which was illegal anyway, he just took him one day. I got a phone call before we played Blackburn at home at the old Manor Ground at Oxford, and it was from Kevin, who was, as I say, my chairman, said, Saunders can't play today, and he's free to go and speak to Derby after the game's finished. And I just said, he's playing, stuff it, and threw the phone down. And he did play, and he scored. But afterwards, obviously I got another phone call, say, right, he can go to Derby. But I'd been promised him for the season, and I just kind of thought, you know what, if I let this happen once, it's always going to happen. And I actually got sacked by the Maxwell family on the following Monday. We played on the Saturday. I actually got sacked for threatening to resign on the family, and apparently no one ever does that.
So come post your time with Keegan at Newcastle, and you're thinking about your next move, you decided punditry was the way to go. Was that a big, tough decision?
It wasn't a tough decision, because Kenny came in, didn't he, at Newcastle, and he just said to me, he said, Laura, what have you been doing? I said, nothing. I said, I'm the fittest person on the coaching staff. I've hardly done any sessions.
Mm.
And he said, do you enjoy it? I said, well, I've not done anything. And at the same time, Niall Sloan, who I mentioned before, basically in charge of the personnel for Match of Day, etc., he came to me and he said, look, this might be a good time or might be a bad time for you. Would you fancy coming to do Match of the Day? And my deal at Newcastle with Kevin was that I could still go and commentate for the radio on games, etc., and all that kind of stuff. And so I still kind of kept my hand in. And I said, do you know what, Niall? Yeah, let's talk. Anyway, I went to see Kenny, and Kenny said, look, absolutely fine. He said, because I'm bringing Alan Irving in anyway. He said, because I've seen him coach, the way he coaches and stuff. And he said, I haven't really got a job for you. And I said, absolutely. I said, this works out perfectly. He gave me a few quid for leaving, which was also good. And then I just obviously started with Match of the Day.
Mm. To jump around a bit, you made your Ireland debut as a 20-year-old. It was a nil-all draw, a friendly at Dalymount. Johnny Giles, the manager, I think Alan Kelly at Preston had alerted him to your Irish roots.
Yeah.
I had often wondered from afar if we had swept in and took a young kid who maybe might have wanted to play for England down the line and almost got him before he could make that decision. But I've read even just over this weekend, doing a bit of reading, your grandfather was kind of key in this whole decision.
Yeah, Grandad Tommy, yeah, because he was Dungarvan, Waterford. He'd kind of descended from the Huguenots, who were, I think they were basically chased out of France, and the majority of them went to Waterford. His surname was Crotty, which was a French name as well. So, and my granddad, when I was playing at Preston, he said, you're going to play international football? And I said, hey, Grandad, I said, I've only played half a dozen games. I'm in the third division playing for Preston. He said, I would love you to play for Ireland if the chance came up. And basically, I said, yeah, but it was Alan Kelly who knew, obviously, about my granddad and stuff. And Gibber is his known, Alan Kelly. He said to me, if we get you an Irish passport, are you happy to play for Ireland? I said, yeah, because, you know, I promised my granddad. And I remember that day I made my debut. It was a Sunday. It was in Dalymount.
Yeah.
I'd played for Preston the day before. So I played on the Sunday. And then on the Tuesday night, I played again for Preston. So I played three games in 4 days, including making my debut for Ireland.
It's mad how different it is. Did your granddad get to see you play for Ireland?
He didn't get to see me play, but obviously I gave him my first shirt, and I had this massive picture of me kind of as waiting, obviously, to make my debut in terms of the line when the national anthems were played and everything. So he was a happy man.
Yeah, I'm sure he was. You'll have missed it over there, but on the last two Monday evenings here on RTÉ television, it's a two-part documentary called The Boys in Green, and it's about the Charlton years. So there's been a lot of talk about Jack Charlton over the last kind of couple of weeks, you know?
Yeah.
You've worked for some exceptional managers. So, like, Jack in that conversation, I don't get much beyond, Jack let the lads have a good time. Jack was Jack. Jack was, like, right man, right place. And all the players knew what they had to do, even though it was fairly agricultural. Beyond that, like, so Jack as an exceptional manager, can we have that conversation? Or do we almost take a little bit for granted what he did in some respects? We just think, well, he just was himself, and he just told them to go out and do their thing, and there wasn't much to it. But, I mean, clearly, if it was that easy, everyone would be a great manager.
Yeah. No, his basic thing was you didn't play in your own half.
Sure.
That was the first thing. And, you know, people play up front like Aldo, Frank Stapleton, they knew they had to kind of run the channels. His very first game, I think, was against Wales, and myself, Jim Beglin and Ronnie Whelan must have had a rearranged game because we didn't play. But apparently, David O'Leary said to me that in the team talk, he just says, if anybody plays in their own half, especially defenders, he said, I will take them off. So obviously to get his message across. And then what happened was we were due to play in the famous game in Scotland at Hampden Park.
Yeah.
And we met for like a training session at Lillishall. So we all turned up and all the boys are there. And a couple of lads said to me, oh, this will be funny, Laro. We said, because do you know about him saying you can't play in your own half? And I went, no, I've not heard that one. Anyway, well, Jack comes in, says hello to the ones he hadn't met before, myself, Ronnie and Jim, all that kind of stuff, all good. go out, and we literally were going to stay over and everything. The boys just said, look, any chance we can do the training session, have a bit of lunch and go home, because just the time of the season it was. And he said, yeah. So what he did was he came out onto the training pitch with us, and he said to myself, Ronnie and Jim Begley, and he said, right, we're going to do the set pieces that we did against Wales, not successfully, he said, I might add. He said, I want you to watch and you to be able to do them for yourself. So he basically said to the lads, right, show these three what we did. Okay, so free kicks and corners and stuff like that. And at the same time he was doing it, he had a golf umbrella, because obviously it was raining, and he was stood behind the goal where we were putting on this particular thing, and he had his back to us. He wasn't even watching. So after doing a few free kicks and corners and stuff, and it was me, actually. I said to him, oh Jack, I said, we're finished. And he said, are you confident you know what we're doing? And we said, yeah, as you do. And he said, right, end of training. Mm. And as we were walking back to get changed and showered, he just said to me, I need a word with you. So I stopped, obviously. And he said, have the lads told you? And I said, what, told me about not sort of playing in my own half? And he said, yeah. And before I said anything, he said, but don't worry, he says, because when we play Scotland, I want you to play in midfield. Mm. So, hey, you know, I think it was something that's, for him, as far as he's concerned, it was a really clever thing to do. And by the way, we had a surplus of outstanding centre-backs anyway, didn't we? McCarthy, Dave O'Leary, Paul McGrath.
Yeah, and just an amazing glut of players generally. So if I had to ask you, you know, what made him... Because, that again, that story is like a classic Jack story. He's you know, forgetting people's names, or like, go on, go do the training kick routine and I won't even watch. And so you're wondering, well, what's the secret sauce here? So what was Jack's secret sauce?
Jack, I think he was very good at summing up players, and he had the problem with Liam, didn't he? He had the problem with Liam Brady, because Liam was just absolutely outstanding player, he was a brilliant player, and Jack didn't really want him in the team, if we're all being truthful, because Liam would slow the game down. Liam could play football at walking pace, which is very, very difficult to do, especially at that level. So that was a problem. But he just weighed people up straight away, and I think he just decided, he said, right, we're having no grey areas. If I tell them that, you know, as soon as you get the ball at the back, look into the channels, and we push everybody up and we squeeze people in, he just thought, if we're going to make mistakes, make them in the opposition half. And you know, it's never ever in black and white, is it? Sometimes you've got to play your way out of trouble in your own half and stuff like that. But that was the basic premise. And, you know, he'd say to Packy, just get it up there. But, you know, then he'd say to people like Frank Stapleton and Aldo, and say that if Packy's kicking it out of his hand, go and stand on the fullback. He said, because their two centre-backs will be heading and kicking the ball all day, but the fullbacks generally weren't particularly good in the air. So that's just the way that it was. He just had a very definitive way of this is how we play, and it was almost, you know, if we score through people's mistakes, we score through people's mistakes.
So I guess clarity is the point, really.
Yeah, which
can be a
better
rarity.
Way of describing it, yeah. Certainly.
An extraordinary evening, and like a tragic evening, so I don't want, you know, want to get the wording right on this, was Heysel in 1985, Liverpool-Juventus, European Cup final, fans dead at the game, and word has filtered through to the dressing room that there are fans dead.
Yeah.
Why did that game go ahead?
I'll tell you why it went ahead. Because the chief of police, Brussels, came into our dressing room and said to us, you are playing this game. I am now responsible for everybody's safety. You are playing this game. He said, because if we suddenly decide that this game is not happening, I can't kind of say to everyone, oh, you're going to be safe, because obviously there was thousands of angry Juventus fans, etc. So straight away, I think it might have been Joe Fager, one of the coaching staff, said, well, have you spoken to Juventus? He said, I have, and I've told them that we are playing football. And that's basically obviously what happened. I mean, we knew of one or two deaths, but Joe Fagan stopped us going out the dressing room after a while. And we just basically sat in there while, you know, basically hell was happening. I remember my mum didn't come to the match. My stepfather came with a friend of his, and he obviously had VIP tickets and walked a particular way, and all he saw were body bags, and they thought that there'd been a bomb, that the bomb had gone off.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, I dislocated my shoulder a couple of times, and I was always going to have an operation, and once the game started, which obviously was a complete waste of time, in less than two minutes, I fell tackling Platini, of all people, and then I fell on my shoulder, and it just came out. So I spent the night in hospital, which wasn't great either.
As I understand it, you would have seen bodies coming in from the stadium that evening?
No.
No? Okay.
No.
That's a mistake.
No, we didn't see any bodies. Absolutely no bodies whatsoever. None of the players in that squad saw any bodies. No, okay. There's absolutely no way, because we couldn't.
Mm.
Because we were just locked down in the dressing room. And
oh, no, I meant at the hospital that night when you were taken to hospital with your shoulder.
Well, I was smuggled into the hospital. I was still in my kit, and basically it was an ambulance, but it was like an extended wheelbase. It was almost like a car thing, and I had to lie in the back, because when I actually got to the hospital, the car backed into this. It was like the only description I can give you, like a loading bay, and they just said, lie down, boots on and everything, and all my kit, and I went straight into the surgery, and they were all waiting for me, all gowned up, and said, you know, this is where you are, blah, yeah. Blah, 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 I'm going to put your shoulder back, the surgeon said, etc., and all that kind of stuff. But the worst thing for me was when I woke up in the morning, obviously not in my kit or anything like that, but after the anaesthetic, and I wouldn't be great after anaesthetic, to be quite honest with you, and I kind of woke up kind of startled, and at the bottom of my bed was a soldier with the biggest machine gun you've ever seen, who didn't speak any English, but he just looked at me and put his hand up to say, like, hold on a minute. And there were 24 beds in the ward. I was the only person in there. The door was locked, and he knocked on the door and let one of the nurses, told the nurses to come in who spoke English, and she just said, you know, you've had your operation and all that kind of stuff, mm. One thing and another, and somebody will come and get you in the morning and take you back to the team hotel.
Yeah, so he's there literally for your protection.
Yeah.
That's a surreal night, to say the least. If I go back, say, a happier time, a year earlier, and the Stadio Olimpico, and you know, people know about this team and Chris Ray in the tunnel, and you know, Souness leading the team on the lap before the game to tell the ultras of Roma that we're not that fussed about you lot.
Yeah.
So you've got Grobler, you've got Phil Neal, you've got Lawrenson and Hansen, you've got Kennedy, then you've got Craig Johnston, Sammy Lee and Souness, you've got Ronnie Whelan, you've got Kenny Dalglish and Ian Rush, and you've got a very impressive bench as well. The dynamics of that team, like, so who are the dominant, I mean, I can kind of guess from afar, but I'd be interested to hear from you. Who are the dominant characters in that dressing room? Who are the quieter lads who probably still have a big influence? Who are, you know, the good foot soldiers that go along with things? Because it just seemed like that's a very memorable team. Like, all of those people are people of substance.
Yeah. Souness was the overwhelming dominant person in the team. He was the one that everybody looked up to. Kenny as well, but in a different kind of way. Phil Neal, would be as well, because he played in so many games and won so many trophies, etc. And probably Hansen, because he was a really intelligent guy and stuff, and you know, worked everything out very, very, very quickly. But it was... it was kind of a dressing where anybody could say anything.
Right.
And, you know, quite a few times, not that often, but quite a few times were coming at half-time and it wasn't happening, and people would point fingers at each other. We had that much kind of belief and understanding and trust with players, and you knew you could push people's buttons. And we had loads of flare-ups. You know, everyone kind of seems to think we turned up every week and we won and it was really easy and all that kind of stuff. Well, it never was.
Mm.
But definitely Graham was the guy, really. And when Joe Fagan got the job in the summer, so that would be 83, wouldn't it? The summer of 83. He got called into the office first day of pre-season, and they always got called in to tell you where you were going on a pre-season trip. Would you believe they were taking us to Marbella? They didn't have a clue.
Hmm.
All about, anyway, that was a different story, and that's a different book. But Graham just came in and he just was laughing and said, "You'll never guess where we're going." We're going, "No, don't tell us. We're going to Poland." And we're going, "No, we're going to Marbella." So we all started laughing and going, "Yeah, of course we are." He said, "No, we are." But then he said, "But," and what happened around the football club is one or two people were saying that there's no way that Joe Fagan could take this forward. He couldn't do any better than obviously Bob Paisley had done. And Bob was still staying there as well, in kind of like an overlord sort of position. And we loved Joe Fagan, absolutely loved him. Every single person who ever played for him loved him to death. And he said, "Let's make sure we don't disappoint this year." And obviously we went on to win the three trophies with Joe, which was fabulous. But Joe was a shrewdie. Mm. He very rarely shouted, and if he did, the paint would peel off the walls. I think I can only remember twice as manager when he absolutely went for it, went for all of us when we needed it. Mm. But he was just he was like a really clever man. I mean, we went to Coventry. I think we were doing extremely well in the league, and we were 3-0 down at half time. Got beat 4-0. Little Terry Gibson scored a hat trick.
Yeah.
It was Hansen's fault. I kept telling everybody. But so we go in at full time. We thought, "Oh, we're going to cop it." Me and Al thought, you know, "You're the culprits. We're going to really cop it." And we're all in there waiting for him. He sat down and he waited and waited. And we're thinking, "Oh, for God's sake, just say something." Nobody said anything. We're all waiting for it. And he looked at us two, me and Hansen, and he said, "You two Herberts," he said, "tell me something." And went, "What, Joe?" We didn't have to really call him boss. He was just like, you could call him Joe. Mm. And he said, "Promise me that doesn't happen again." And we went in unison, "No." He went, "Right, get changed, showered, on the bus, let's go home."
Yeah. How did you and Hansen, that relationship, was that one where you two talked a lot about how you were going to approach the game? Or
no.
Was it fairly telepathic? Yeah.
No, telepathetic. Do you know what we realised after quite a few years? That we both got our Latin O-level at school. I mean, how unusual is that? But I think what it was trust. I mean, when I went to Liverpool in 81, Bob Paisley said to me, "Look," he said, "we know where we want to play you eventually, but we also think you can play, you know, in various different positions," which I did. And Phil Thompson was still there.
Yeah.
So it was Tomo and Al and stuff. And it was only through injury that eventually I got in there, and then they said to Tomo, who's probably, in all honesty, his legs were going, he went to Sheffield United, that we had this kind of partnership. But even when we had this partnership, quite a number of occasions, I went and played in midfield.
Right.
Even when Souness was there, and then when Sui left at 84 after winning the European Cup, Joe said to me, he said, "Look, you're probably going to play more in midfield now because obviously, you know, Souness is gone until we kind of work out what we want to do." So, but it was just easy with Al. It was just, I think where we were extremely lucky was that we had lots of pace, and if either of us made a mistake, we had enough pace to kind of rectify the position. But the game was too easy for him. He just used to waltz through the game. Honestly, you could just fold his kit up and put it ready for the next game, and I was covered in snot and blood and everything. And you used to look at him and you just think, "Oh my God, how easy is that?" But you know, this fella played three different sports for Scotland, so he was just multi talented.
Did he?
And we didn't.
What three sports did he play?
Squash, golf, and football.
Did he really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And yeah, it is a wow. And yes. He was just. We never. You know, we were big mates. We lived really close to each other, and stuff. And we never really talked about players who were going to play. We kind of both worked out that what we needed to do against certain players. The only time he ever said to me, he said to me one day, we went to Oxford of all places, who'd been promoted, and he had a guy called Billy Whitehurst who played up front. He was a thug. He was just a thug. And Billy would just quite happily come and just punch you in the face, you know, while the ball was down the other end. That's the way that Billy was. I actually met him quite a few times afterwards because he lived in Oxford when I was managing. He was absolutely fine, but he was just nuts. Mm. So we're in the dressing room before this game at the Manor Ground, and Al said, "Who's this Billy Whitehurst fella? I've never even heard of him." And I said, "Oh, you don't want to be anywhere near him, by the way, because, like, you know." So I said, he'll do whatever to you. And he went, Anyway, so big slope at the Manor Ground, and Oxford kicked off, right? And Billy Whitehurst was in the left wing position by the halfway line, because obviously the ball went to Dave Lankin, who had played with, obviously, for Ireland, as the right back at Oxford, and he just His idea was to launch it diagonally, and Billy would come in off the left wing, and whoever played right centre back was good luck with that one.
Yeah.
Because Billy would just pole action. And I said to Al, I said, honestly, mate, seriously, I said, of all the people we played against, you know, the Joe Jordans and all those people, and I said, you've never played against anything like this. And sure enough, they kicked off, went back to Lange, he launched it, diagonal ball, Billy came running in at Al, and Al had sort of cleverly looked at him and looked where the ball was and thought, none of us are going to get this ball. So Al just kind of did a little bit of a sidestep. Billy went to absolutely clean him out, landed on his back and got carried off. Did his back in, and I said to Al, you will never realise how lucky you've been. He just started laughing.
Oh, dear. And he's good looking too. Jeez, he has everything. My God,
Hanson.
How many of you guys, the Liverpool crew from that vague period, are all still knocking around that area?
There are. Well, I'll name them first. So there's Kenny, Al, me, Jim Beglin, Ronnie Whelan, Steve McMahon, Alan Kennedy. I'm sure I've missed some. I think there's eight or nine of us.
Ian Rush, I think, is he?
No, Rush is not there. Oh, Steve McMahon,
yeah.
It was a little bit later. Rush is not. Rushy lives on the world. So, yeah, I think there's eight or nine, certainly.
Mm. Here's a terribly unfair question from a listener.
Go on.
Motson or Barry Davies?
Motson. The reason I'm a Motson man, because he said I kind of resurrected his career when I started commentating with him. I mean, I used to call Barry Lord Barrington of Davies because he was definitely from like upper class stock. But they were just completely different. And I remember my first ever TV commentary was with Barry.
Mm.
And it was Liverpool, must have been a European game, and Niall Sloan said to me, he said, completely different from radio, he said, less is more, and I said, yeah, okay, Niall, not an issue. Anyway, I think I spoke about four times in the whole of the commentary, and I said, you weren't wrong about less is more, he said, well, not really supposed to be, but that was just Barry, but, and I got on famously with both of them, I really enjoyed the company, but Motson.
Really?
Who's raving mad, by the way?
Is he?
Oh, he was, honestly, he was one of those commentators. Everyone said to him about, you know, the statistics and all that kind of stuff, but he never, ever, ever got anything wrong. He always got the moment right as well, but he'd be a nightmare before you actually started.
Right.
And I learned quickly that, you know, he used to get there ridiculously early, 2.5 hours before the game, and I'd go and say hello to him just so he knew I was there. And I would just leave him to do what he did, and he'd be down the tunnel, he'd be asking, you know, everybody, what's the team, did it, all those kind of stuff, and have himself in such a state, and he'd be up on the commentary position. And I would just literally be up there 10 minutes before, and all we had a conversation about was, I would say to him, how do you pronounce this name? So I just said, if we both pronounce it the same, it doesn't really matter and stuff. But he was, once he got to the altar, he was absolutely outstanding. But getting him there wasn't easy. And there was a lot of people who kind of tried to kind of look after him before games, and they soon went down the road.
Right, okay. God, it's funny, these things. I'm a Davies man, and it's not even close. It's just funny how subjective it all is.
Yeah. I mean, Barry had some fabulous lines, didn't he?
Mm, yeah.
And a very, very educated man. I mean, he commentated on loads of stuff. Do you know, by the way, do you know how John Motson started?
No.
Boxing.
Really?
And do you know, one day, even in those days, he had this, they didn't call it a co-commentator in those days, but he did this, he was at the boxing, he was commentating. You'll never, ever guess who was co-commentating with him.
Go on.
Muhammad Ali.
Stop, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Never heard that.
And by the way, Des was a boxing commentator, Des Lynam, and that's really what he wanted to do rather than football.
Interesting. I guess maybe they grew up to a point during the golden era. Maybe
yeah.
That was part of it. This tricky question, because for part of these periods you were a player, and so I presume being a player is the best time of your life. But I was going to ask you, you know, so from mid-70s at Preston right through to this unrecognisable world now, what was the perfect blend of kind of the old school values meets the new age preparation and the technical quality of football, and then the fans and all, you know, the many variables of play? What was the best decade for football if you were to re-watch it or relive it again?
For me?
Yeah, with it, and I need you to separate your time as a player. I just mean, like, when was football at its most enjoyable, at its best?
I would think now.
Yeah, right.
I would think now because, you know, supporters understand the game much, much more. I mean, the analysis on all the games now is absolutely fabulous. You know, facilities, pitches, everything about it is fabulous. It was just different. It's like, you know, people keep saying to you, well, you know, the team at Liverpool at the moment, do you think they would beat your team? And I would say, I normally say, yeah, just as, you know, so you avoid an argument. Mm. But it was just completely different. The whole thing was different. The pitches were awful. You'd have fillet steak 3 hours before you played. I mean, everyone would laugh about stuff like that now. Travel, drinking, all those kind of things. I think we probably had more fun. In fact, I know we had more fun.
Right.
And at the moment, we're probably still more successful, that team of the 80s, because of all the stuff we won. But you look at Liverpool in general, you look at football now, and wow, it hasn't half kind of finessed. It's just, you know, with the Premier League, it's like Hollywood every week. Every single game, the build-up, etc. As I say, the analysis, all those kind of things. But also, I think now that, you know, the supporters are really, really well educated in tactics, formations, all those kind of things. Now, I mean, you know, someone, you have a conversation with somebody you think knows nothing about it, and he's describing to you what the low block is.
Yeah.
I'm going, right, leave that one with you.
And if it's lost anything, what's the biggest thing it's lost?
Oh, I think it's lost its soul a little bit. I think you have to be a little bit careful with some of the spectators, etc. It's a bit like all this stuff at the moment with the coronavirus. I don't know why, you know, every single team in the Premier League doesn't go, you know what, boys, this week all your wages are going to the NHS. And to be fair, the amount of money that these lads earn, they would not miss it, and it would just be an absolutely fantastic gesture. And I just think they miss things like that. And I worry. I mean, I love football, as I said to you before, and I go to every single game, loads of games. But I just worry that, you know, there's almost like a misconnection with supporters and players now. But, you know, when I go to Anfield, and if I'm working for LFC TV, I'm there 3 hours before, and the place is mobbed.
Yeah.
Outside, and you're going, what are they all doing? Don't kick off for 3 hours, but it's just become this massive social event, hasn't it? And it is fabulous. And we do this thing in front of the cop for about an hour before the game starts, finishing 10 minutes before the game starts, and you just watch the stands fill up. And we are that close to the supporters, but you know, you just hear so many different foreign languages, and you kind of think, wow, how has this thing developed?
Yeah, it sure has. Listen, thanks so much for giving us your time. It's really appreciated.
No problem. I wasn't going anywhere.
Well, that's the thing. Sorry, I forgot the most important question. Very quickly, the haircut.
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody slaughtered. Obviously, my hair was receding, and I kept saying to my better half, Kathy, I said, I'm going to have it all shaved off. And she looked at me and she went, really? And I said, yeah, I've had enough of it. And she said, all right. Anyway, I slipped out the other morning and I went into the hairdresser and I said to the woman who's cut my hair for ages, and I said, number two. And she went, yeah, very funny. I said, no, number two. And she went, oh, no. Well, let me start with number four and see how we go. And I went, nah, number two. And she, you know what? Should have done it years ago.
Well, good man. Listen, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it. Back to the self-isolation.
Happy days.
Yeah, cheers. Mark Lawrence in there. Thanks, Mark. See ya.
Football on Off the Ball.
With Paddy Power. The greatest football partnership since Jeff and Heskey.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.